Much thanks to Squarespace.com for sponsoring this episode. If you go to Squarespace and use offer code Duncan, you will get 10% off of your first purchase. Sign up for a year, and you will get a free domain name. Friends, I've been trying to record the intro to this podcast. I'm having some difficulty doing it because I'm in Hana, Maui, gazing out from my porch on a beautiful swath of incredible Hawaii. All of Hawaii is beautiful. All of Maui is beautiful, but Hana is particularly exquisite to the point where recording intros is nearly impossible because it sounds like I've been sucking back great plumes of high-powered hashish mixed in with opium. I'm just raving. I sound like somebody out of a Coleridge poem or a H.P. Lovecraft story, just babbling about how I think I can talk to the birds. So I don't know how much longer I'm going to attempt to record these intros. And also, I don't have much choice because the battery's running out on my recorder here. So we've just got to jump right into this episode. But I do want to say I've discovered something incredible that I hope you will investigate. I was looking into Ganesh. If you don't know who Ganesh is the elephant-headed Hindu god who has a really amazing backstory. The way Ganesh ended up with an elephant head is pretty amazing. But I realized Ganesh rides around on a mouse or a shrew, and I was really curious about that, so I looked it up. And it's pretty interesting, man. You should definitely check it out because of all the vehicles, as they're called. All the Hindu gods have vehicles that they ride around in, and the way that there's like mounts in World of Warcraft, the Hindu gods, some of them ride around on, I don't know, eagles, I think, or dragons or whatever. But Ganesh, the remover of obstacles, the god that represents the grace that allows you to get past what appears to be some of the most impossible barriers in your life, chose as his mount a shrew or a mouse. And in some of the paintings, the rat kind of looks like a little bit like a dick. Like it doesn't, you know, like in some of the paintings, it doesn't even look like the sweetest mouse or rat or shrew or whatever it is. But I think this is the most genius idea because there's different ways of looking at it, but the idea is that on one level, mice can get anywhere. They can go anywhere. They're so good at like squeezing through tiny little cracks or going into places that it seems like it would be impossible to get to. And then on another level, rats or mice, especially when the mythology of Hinduism was being formed, they were catastrophic. It was if you got mice in your crops or in your grain house, or if mice got into your pantry, or if mice got anywhere, then they could destroy your business. So it's so profound that the being that is responsible for getting you through the most difficult times in your life rides around on a symbol for that thing that can destroy your life or screw you up royally. It's a really cool thing. I love it. It's the idea that whatever your particular obstacle is, whatever the thing is that is in your way, the thing that you're resisting, the thing that you wake up freaking out over, the thing that comes to you in the middle of the day and fills your stomach with acids and makes you shit blood if you have ulcers. Hopefully that's not happening. But whatever the thing is, that is actually potentially your vehicle. That is the thing that you can use to ride around or through over or in to whatever your obstacle may be. And that's such a cool idea, man. It really is. And, you know, we all know what the actual obstacle is. If you study any of this stuff at all, the actual obstacle, it's quite often your ego. It has nothing to do with the external world and more to do with some blockage inside of you, some inability to harmonize with whatever is going on in your life more than some external thing. It's always your ego, usually. But I like Ganesh, you know, opposed to some of the other gods, the more ferocious Hindu gods like Kali or Shiva, who represent different methods or ways that the universe can help you overcome, annihilate, come to terms with, whatever you want to say, different ways for you to deal with your ego. You know, Kali is a ferocious, terrifying looking being. And that's one way that the universe takes care of our ego problems. I feel like I've kind of experienced that a little bit. You know, that's when you end up with cancer or a family member passing. And, you know, I was just having a conversation with somebody out here in Hawaii, and I'm about to have a billion amazing conversations because I'm going to a Ram Dass retreat, and I got to hang out with some of the Ram Dass satsang and had a cool conversation with someone out here who experienced a pretty tragic loss. And she was talking about how, what, you know, a lot of people don't understand is when you experience a loss, when you experience some kind of profound loss in your life, it ends up teaching you how to be happy. And I guess that's what Kali represents, is this thing that seems just brutal, and something you'd never want to invite into your life, ends up on the other side being the thing which gives you so much joy and happiness and lets you really connect to life. But I like Ganesh because maybe Ganesh represents not necessarily having to go through some catastrophe to get to that point of happiness. Maybe Ganesh represents not having to join the dead mom's club or the dead friends club to get to the place where you realize how beautiful life is. Maybe Ganesh represents another pathway to get to that profound state of being grateful just for your life, just for the ability to stand up, just for the ability to inhale. And maybe you don't always have to go through some kind of miserable hell to get to that place. Maybe the world and the beauty of the world is enough to get you there. And maybe if you're particularly smart, and you're not like some of us, you don't need to have a mind detonate in your life to realize how cool this place is. Either way, I'm getting into Ganesh. Study Ganesh's mouse, a rat, or a shrew, because it's a supremely cool symbol, especially for those of you out there who are dealing with some particular struggle. All right, that's enough of me rambling. I'm sorry. I'm about to go to a meditation retreat. Friends, we have a mind-bendingly psychedelic and somewhat clumsy episode of the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast for you today. This episode was recorded inside of virtual reality. So in virtual reality, you run into a few problems. Number one, you don't have the normal cues from the audience. People can't really applaud in virtual reality. They have to emote, which means they press these buttons that create hearts or smiley faces or frowny faces floating above their head. Number two, you don't get the normal visual cues from the people you're talking to, which means that it's really easy to step on what somebody else is saying or for them to step on what you're saying. And so it can kind of create a bit of a jumbled conversation that isn't in the normal rhythm that human conversations are in. Now, these are just, I think, temporary encumbrances that are being worked through by folks like the people over at Altspace VR, who are actually pioneers in this technology. I'm sure that in a few years, 2 years, maybe 5 years, as virtual reality becomes increasingly indistinguishable from reality, these kinds of things are going to be looked at as just temporary roadblocks. It's a little clumsy. I hope that you'll be patient with it. If it sounds a little off or it sounds like our conversation gets a little jumbled together, we're still trying to figure out the best way to put on shows in virtual reality. But all that being said, this was a really intense conversation that I had with Drew. I know a lot of you guys know he's an amazing comedian. Some of you have seen him on The Price is Right, but I don't know how many people are aware that Drew is deeply into Buddhism and meditation, and he's actually been something of a teacher to me as well as a really good friend. So we're going to jump right into this episode, but first... Okay, friends, today's guest truly needs no introduction. Squeeze your inner child out of your third eye and send that sweet little flower baby blasting in the direction of our wonderful guest's heart chakra. Everybody, please welcome to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour Podcast, the beautiful Drew Carey. Hey guys, just to preface this, a little bit of this got cut off because of a technical error. This is the first question I had for Drew, but it was about the fact that he had just met that day with the Dalai Lama's oracle. Also, any bleeps or bloops you hear in the background, that's the sound of emoticons, which are the virtual reality version of laughter and applause. Okay, here we go.
So, hello, friend. Sorry. You mean you can't expect this to work perfectly. It's insane that it works at all. But Drew, so I was going to say how it's so funny to me that you kind of casually talk about getting to hang out in with the Dalai Lama's oracle. Because yeah. I've looked at YouTube videos of him. First of all, I don't think a lot of people are aware of the fact that the Dalai Lama has an oracle. But what's really interesting is when you see what he does in these rituals, it's insane, man. Like, he goes into a full kind of voodoo trance.
Yeah, where he puts on this shakes. Then he puts on this giant headset, which in this like thing that weighs like 60 pounds or something, and he puts it on his head and just like moves his neck around and dances around with it on. That would, like, a normal person would just like really hurt their neck. And he's 60 years old, and or he's going to be 60 next July, so he's 59 years old. So he's just like a, you know, and he's a monk. It's not like he's in the weight room every day, but he puts on this big giant thing and just dances around with this. You got to look up the YouTube videos of it. It's pretty crazy, but he's in this trance. He has like the strength of 10 men. And then the Oracle advises the Dalai Lama through him. So he's not the actual Oracle. He's the, like, the conduit. And he's the one that gives the information to the Dalai Lama.
Right. But he's getting possessed by some kind of spirit is what's happening, right?
Yes.
So,
yes.
Yeah, I don't think people know that that even happens, because when I watch that video, it definitely reminds me of videos I've seen of people going into like voodoo trances where spirits possess them.
Yeah, I don't think it was him. It was like another oracle before him. He's the one that advised the Dalai Lama to skedaddle out of Tibet when the Chinese were coming.
Wow.
So, yeah, like for example, that kind of thing.
Does he advise you?
Yeah, I think he used those actual words, skedaddle. No, he doesn't advise me at all. Although we've had some really interesting conversations, and just being around this guy, like, I remember one time last Thanksgiving? I think I was late for dinner, and he was in town, and I was going to meet him, and I was getting really annoyed at traffic, and I was late, and just like, ugh. And it was the Thanksgiving before, a couple years ago, and I stopped by this one house. The temple wasn't built yet. I stopped by this one house to meet with him. And as soon as I walked in and shook his hand, every stress went away. Just being around this guy, he's so loving and non-judgmental. And just being around somebody like that, we have to worry about anything, is great. Like, he has just a really good presence about him. So it was kind of nice.
But when he becomes possessed with the oracle, Do they do it in the United States, or do they in India?
He only does it every once in a while for the Dalai Lama. It's a special ceremony that they all get together for. It's not something he just does.
It looks painful to him. It looks like it hurts.
He goes, he travels, and he helps raise money, and he advises temples and, like, you know, helps pick out, like, different lamas that are going to come teach, or different monks that are going to come teach at the different temples. And he's like a bishop in a Catholic church kind of thing. Like, if you can think of him as that, or a cardinal.
When did you start getting into Buddhism?
A few years ago. You know, when I met this guy, when was it? It was probably like 8 years ago, 8-10 years ago, somewhere around there.
It
was such a gradual thing. It's not like I went to a Buddhist meeting and became a Buddhist one day. I just got, you know, started studying different philosophies of things and just eventually became a Buddhist.
What is it about Buddhism that appeals to you the most?
Last year I went to, I did a pretty life-changing thing. I went to a Vipassana meditation class. I don't know if you ever heard of these things. It's a 10-day course. They teach it all over the world. Yeah, you can go to dhamma.org, dhamma.org, and look up their centers all over the world. And they don't charge anything. They only ask for donations. You don't have to donate a thing. It's free if you want it to be. They feed you and everything. And it's 10 days of meditation. You get up at 4 in the morning. You start meditating at 4:30. And you meditate all day till like 9 o'clock at night. And there's breaks for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and little 5-minute breaks in between. But it's pretty intense. And they teach you this technique that the Buddha taught to people. There's been lots of Buddhas before him and after him, but the famous one that Buddhism is named after. So they teach that form of meditation. And the idea is to rid yourself of craving and aversion. And the meditation is a practice of that. So while you're meditating, you're not craving anything and you're not averse to anything. Because in Buddhism, craving and aversion is the basis of all suffering. You want something, you don't get it, you're sad, you're mad, you suffer. You have an aversion to something somebody you think is attacking you or calling you a name or stealing something you think you own. And that causes you suffering. So it teaches you to let go of all that kind of thinking. And it's a good philosophy. It helps, especially in show business. You know, I don't know if anybody have ever read that book or heard of this book called The Four Agreements. That's kind of Buddhist-y, because one of the second agreement is don't take anything personally, which is fits right into Buddhism. Like, you can't, anytime that you can't be insulted, nobody can hurt you, nobody can hurt your car or get into an accident with you or steal anything from me, because it doesn't bother you anymore, because you realize that you can't take anything personally and nothing is yours. And, you know, it's kind of a nice philosophy of life.
It's a nice philosophy, but I've heard different versions of it, but
there's a lot to it.
There's a lot to it.
Try to give it 1 minute.
It's a great synopsis of the thing. There's a lot to it. But how do you, as Drew Carey, let's say working on The Price is Right, when do you find yourself using the tools that you've learned from Vipassana or Buddhism? Like, what are some examples of you making this stuff actionable in your life?
Whenever somebody insults me on Twitter or doesn't think I do a good job on The Price is Right or says something bad about me or writes a bad article, I used to get really upset about that stuff when I was on the Drew Carey show, especially early on. I read a bad article, I would be like, what the hell? Who's this person? You know, who they think they are. And now I just don't care. Honestly. Like, you could write a whole book or a website called Drew Carey Sucks and just insult me every day, and it wouldn't even register with me, I don't think.
So
by the way.
Don't do it. Who would do that? You're America's sweetheart. No one's gonna do that to you. You're the sweetest man on earth.
That doesn't bother me, and I don't take the compliments that seriously either. It's all, I'm just saying, like, since we're all avatars, this is a basic thing. Like, nobody can insult you. You're just an avatar for somebody. You know, if you're like Duncan, you have a beard. So somebody might have a problem with somebody with beards from their childhood or a bad, you know, experience they had or a bad relationship. And they see you, they don't like you, they don't like your voice or so, whatever it is, they just, you just drive them crazy. And there's nothing you can do about it because it's not you. It's between them and their relationship to the universe. It has nothing to do with you at all. So why would it even bother you? They might as well be calling you a Martian or something. And that's how I started to look at it. It's like, is somebody calling you a Martian? Like, it just doesn't matter. It sounds so stupid. Hey, you're a frog. You know you're not a frog.
Yeah.
So why would you get upset at that? It's just somebody dealing with the world. We're all children in certain ways. This is another one of my basic philosophies, if you want to talk about all this kind of stuff, that we're all children in all different aspects of our life. Like, when you're a child, you learn different things. But also when you're an adult, you're a supposed adult, you're presented with all these different situations you've never been in before, you don't know anything about. So in that respect, in that situation, you're a child. So right. If somebody is mad at you or has a thing with you, they haven't learned how to deal with this situation yet or how to deal with somebody like you or deal with the thing they're in. So in that respect, they're a child. So you have to be able to forgive them just like you would forgive a child. Like when, if you, anybody has kids, if you have a 5-year-old or 4-year-old, it doesn't mean you like it when they're throwing a tantrum or screaming. That's, you know, you want them to stop. You don't want to hang around somebody that's doing that, but you don't show up the next day and go, oh, there's that son of a bitch that was yelling at me yesterday. You don't do that to a 5-year-old because you're going to get, the 5-year-old doesn't know any better. Well, anybody that does anything to you doesn't know any better. And that helps you, if you can go through that thought process, it really helps you to have forgiveness for that other person, because they literally, it's like Christ on the cross when he said they don't know what they're doing. They literally don't know what they're doing because they've never been in that situation. And they, even if they've been in the situation over and over and keep doing the same thing, the universe is presenting them, here's the situation you have to learn to deal with. They don't get it, they get the lesson again. They don't get it, they get the lesson again. Okay. They keep repeating the class until they get it.
Yeah. Okay, so, all right. But what about... when it's somebody who is clearly maliciously doing something to you? Like, I hear everything you're saying, and I do agree with it, but I know that some people, when they hear that stuff, they react to it. But I guess I'll give the worst admonition of Buddhism I ever heard. They call it, one of my friends said, you're just engaging in passive hipster Buddhism. It's a form of passivity. It's a trained form of passivity where you are telling yourself, well, you know, this is a child, Father forgive them, they know not what they do. But really the reality is that life is more akin to what Nietzsche taught. It's about power. It's like you must fight back. If you don't fight back, then people will take advantage of you. So what do you do from a Buddhist perspective when you get the feeling that somebody is taking more than they should?
First of all, I don't, it takes so much psychic energy to deal with somebody who's constantly hurting you, constantly going after you. That's why I've broken up with people like five.
Right.
And that's why there's friends that I don't see as much anymore, that I don't see at all anymore, because they're just too much to handle. I don't want the negativity. I don't want that burden of having them around. I don't go to places where I'm going to be challenged all the time. Like I don't purposely put myself into places or even try to accidentally where I think, oh, this is going to be, everybody's going to be fighting me and hating me, because it's just going to be this constant psychic battle in my head, forgiving you, rationalizing all that stuff. So first of all, I avoid all that stuff. Yeah, it means you don't have to hang around these people at all. If somebody in your life is doing bad things to you or hurting you, just get away and don't deal with them. Let them go off and be mad on their own.
All right, so let's say that that person is your mom and you're 17, or that because a lot of people end up in families where they can't escape. Or
here's another one of my basic beliefs that I have that really helped me out, that we're all here to like purpose of life thing. We're all here to teach and learn. And that's what I really believe. So you're always teaching other people something, whether you know it or not, whether it's conscious or not. You're teaching them love. You're teaching them patience. You're teaching them how not to be. We can talk about Trump in that respect if you want to, because that's a
– sure.
I've come up with my anti-Trump shield because of that. And it's like – you're always learning for something. So for some – you don't know if somebody really does something awful to you or is being really bad where it's really in your face, you should ask yourself, what's the lesson I'm trying to learn here? Like, am I supposed to learn to be more patient? Am I supposed to learn not to be so needy? Am I supposed to learn to be not so greedy about my things? You know, if I got robbed, was I too attached to my car? Is that why my car got in an accident? Yeah. Was I too attached to this thing? Is that why it was destroyed by this other person? Right. What's the lesson I'm supposed to learn in my life from this? And take the lesson and then move on. That makes sense?
Right. Yeah, totally. But so what now? That's what so I, what about
what I was
Drew,
talking about?
What, sorry.
Go ahead. No, I was talking about Trump because Trump is like I'm not a big fan of his. I'm sorry if you are. I'm not trying to argue with you about it. Vote for if you want to. But to me, he's a teacher. And he's like, I read it. Was it the New York Times or something? Something wrote about how all the great things he's doing for women right now, which is true. And it's the same kind of philosophy. Like, because all this stuff is coming out about him, the way he treats women and the way he treats people, everybody is learning how not to behave. And everybody is seeing how the world abhors that and how many people are like, oh my God, that's horrible. So anybody that's even borderline like that or thought that was cool because their friends do it is now realizing that's not a way to behave. And because of his, it's almost like he decided before he was born, I'm going to give a gift to the world. I'm going to be the biggest asshole in the world just to teach people to be patient, loving, and more kind. And I think something really good is going to come out of that because of his behavior. And people are going to be treated better from now on, and people are going to be more tolerant from now on. Because you don't want to be like that Trump, you know?
Right.
That's how people are going to raise their kids, and it's going to be different.
Oh, sorry.
I love that. That's beautiful. I love that. I think that's a very beautiful idea. Because I haven't looked at Trump through such an optimistic perspective. Like, regardless of Trump being the
team. I had to think to myself because I would read the paper, go like, oh, this, blah, blah, blah. I'd get so upset and like full of angst. And I thought, oh, no, what's happening to me? What's the lesson I'm trying to learn? And I realized, oh, this guy is a teacher to everybody. Like, so the example of the 17-year-old with the bad parent, Wayne Dyer talked about it. There's a really famous self-help author he died a few years ago who was really influential for me, named Wayne Dyer. And his dad was a big asshole. And he talked about his dad being his teacher. Like the dad said, you know, I want to raise a kid who's patient, loving, and tolerant, so I'm going to be an asshole. So the dad was a total asshole to him, and he had to learn to be patient with everybody, to be loving with everybody. That's the only way he could get through this hell with his father.
Hold on, wait, I'm sorry. Can I cut you off for a second? You're saying that this father said to himself, I want to raise a sweet son, so I'm going to be a fucking asshole?
Well, no, I want to teach people to be patient and kind. So, you know, if I'm poking you and annoying you, which if you can learn from that, be patient with me, you can be patient with everybody and love everybody. If you can put
this is me. What the dad.
So that's my gift to you.
I think that's cool. I mean, I get it conceptually, but it sounds like the worst fucking dad on earth. I'm burning you with this cigarette so you'll learn to love, boy. Yeah, but it's
the worst thing in the world. But you don't know when you're born what kind of lessons you need to learn and how you need to learn them. Everybody gets presented things in a different way.
That's right.
And you could also, if you're 17, just run the fuck away from home and get away from them and try to be around some people that are nice to you.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I do think you do eventually have to become autonomous and get away from the darkness if you can.
Don't be around it. Yeah. And that includes stuff you read and books you read. Like if you're always presenting yourself with dark themes, horrible things, things are bad. Dennis Waitley had a really good thing in one of his books. He said, if a 30-minute commercial can sell you on a product, why can't a 30-minute TV show sell you on a lifestyle? You know, if all you watch is reality shows of people, I like reality shows, but the kind of reality shows where just people are fighting all the time, like those kind of reality shows where it's all about who's mad at who and who's fighting with who, and they can't wait to get in a fight for the camera because that looks good for the camera. That's teaching you that this is a good way to be, that you should be prideful and fighting and don't let anybody say anything bad about you. And at the slightest provocation, just go off and yell because that's the right way to behave. And you might think it's a show, but it's not just a show. That's teaching you a behavior. And the more you watch that, even if you think you're fighting it, that's going to seep in a little bit. Just as if you see a Coca-Cola commercial over and over, next time you're in a store, you're going to subconsciously choose Coca-Cola over Pepsi.
Do you attribute your success as a comedian to these ideas? Do you think, because it seems like you have had as far as like comedy goes, you've had kind of a dream life. Like you have had the most incredible. Yeah, it's amazing. So at what point did these philosophies become part of your lifestyle, or was it always kind of built into you?
No, I had to learn all this stuff. Like when I started doing stand up, even before I started doing stand up, I started listening to like self-help tapes. I would buy like Dennis Whaley, Zig Ziglar, and I would buy like the old cassette tapes I had, and I would put them in. And when I was on the road, I would, instead of listening to music all day long, I would take Zig Ziglar tapes out and I would just pop the first tape in and just listen to 5 hours of Zig Ziglar or Dennis Whaley or whoever, Earl Nightingale, telling me good advice on how to live my life and all these really good philosophies. And then when I get to the hotel room, I'd read, you know, Og Mandino and people like that. And that I had to learn all this stuff. I didn't learn it from my family.
So, but this was happening, like you were absorbing this information before your kind of meteoric success as a comedian. Like this was when you were, this is when you were doing the dirty road. You've told me some stories about going on the road and that are just, toe-curlingly horrible. So as you truly like, for those of you who aren't comedians, there's something comedians call the dirty road. There's two different roads. There's the dirty road and then there's the road. The dirty road is where you drive yourself from point A to point B, no flights. So you're driving like between 4 to God knows how many hours a day. You maybe have enough time to get somewhere to take a shower. Maybe you're sleeping in your car. You go on stage in front of maybe nobody in roadhouses and shit clubs all across the country. And a lot of comics are out there doing it right now. And that's called the dirty road. Drew, how long were you on the dirty road for? You spent some time out there, right?
Oh. I was in Cleveland and I was in this relationship with this girl. We actually talked about getting married. It was a really serious relationship. And, I missed doing the Tonight Show, which is another long story. And I decided I have to go out to LA cause I didn't want to miss doing the Tonight Show again. So I said, we got to move. So we packed up all the stuff and we moved out to California, and I was on the road for like 3 weeks out of the month constantly. And we didn't have any money and she had to get a part-time job somewhere. Like we weren't seeing each other at all. We had no money. And we ended up breaking up, and I was so heartbroken about it. Cause it really, we did talk about like, you know, how nice it would be to get married and where were we going to get married. And we had all these, like, wouldn't it be nice to be in the bag? We had it like all planned out, even though it wasn't official. We were really in love with each other. And when I broke up, I decided, well, I'm just going to go on the road. And just that, cause I didn't have any place to live right there. And I didn't want to move back to Cleveland. So I packed up my car and I just started gig to gig. And for 18 months, I traveled gig to gig, just driving in my car. And a lot of times, honestly, driving and crying, like some song would come on and trigger it. And it would be nighttime and some love song would come on and I would just like start bawling and just like driving while I was crying. Yeah, it was really rough. And I did that for 18 months. And I was never in any place more than a week. For 18 months, including my old house in Cleveland. My friend Jerry lived there while I was gone. So even when I went back to Cleveland for a week, if I was in that area, I would go sleep on the couch or up in a spare room in my own damn house. And then I would go back on the road again. And I stayed in comedy condos. I stayed in hotels. Everything I owned fit my car. I had a bunch of stuff in storage, but pretty much everything just fit my car. And I would unload my car and arrange the room in a certain order, so it kind of looked like home all the time. And I would put the different pictures out and arrange everything in the bathroom exactly the same way. So I'd always felt like I was a little bit at home. Right. And I did that for 18 months. Then I came back to LA. But when I got back to LA, my act was so strong, I was unstoppable. That's when I got the Tonight Show and all that stuff after that.
So that period of that year and 6 months was kind of the crucible where you became a comedian.
Yeah. I'm telling you, I was like, nothing mattered but my act. Like if I wasn't funny, then I was miserable. He couldn't talk to me, couldn't function. I didn't look anybody in the eye until I did the next show and I was funny. And then I was like, hey, I was like the most swaggy person in the world. It was like way up or way down and just like I couldn't, everything depended on my whole self-worth depended on how I did on stage. Plus, I listened to those self-help types all the time, you know, constantly during the day to keep, to buck myself up and keep myself on track, you know.
Do you remember any moment during that 18 months where you thought, you know what, it's not worth it. I'm going to go live a normal life. This comedy thing.
No. I couldn't wait to get off the road and get back to LA. Like after about a year and a couple months, I was like, well, I got to get back to LA because I'm not doing this forever. Because I could see how somebody could get trapped like that, just keep on doing it. And I just wanted to have I wanted to have a girlfriend. Like I was going to strip clubs all the time just because that was the only time I could see a girl. Like the idea of like hugging somebody and like cuddling or anything like that, I just couldn't do it because I was always on the road, a new place every week. So I would go to a strip club just to cuddle up with somebody and have a talk with a girl. It was crazy.
I just felt lonely
all the time and miserable.
Do you remember, as you're listening to this stuff, do you remember a moment when you actually began to do experiments, practicing some of the stuff that you were hearing on these audiobooks? Do you remember when like you started actually using it during this 18-month period and it started working?
It was such a journey because like there's this book called The University of Success by Og Mandino. And the first chapters are just about self-worth, you know, like you deserve to be successful and you deserve to be happy. And, you know, why can't you be happy? Why shouldn't you have money? Why shouldn't you be what you ever want to be? Why can't you have that degree? You know, like this basic stuff that I had to learn and convince myself, like, why shouldn't I headline? Why shouldn't I be funnier than the next guy? Why can't I be on the Tonight Show? Like, I had to convince myself that it was worth it or that I was worth it. You know, like you'll never accomplish anything if you don't think you're worth it, if you don't think you can, like, why would you bother if you think you're a worthless person? You wouldn't even try. So like, you know, people ask me like, when I lost the weight, what was the first step? Like, you know, what pill did you take? What diet did you go on? The very first step actually was a psychological step. I thought my kid was, I did some math and I was in really bad health. And I think, well, I'm not going to live long enough to see my kid graduate from high school. Mm. And I couldn't even play with them for 5 minutes because I would get too tired. And then to get out of that, I thought, well, I have to get out of that. And to get out of that, Nicole Connor's mom, I remember this is a real key thing. One time she said, I just bought like the sloppiest clothes all the time. I would go to the Gap and I wouldn't even go to the Gap. I would go online and buy like clothes for the summer. And then I would buy clothes for the winter. Twice a year, I'd get this big mail-in order from the Gap. Underwear, socks, everything, because I knew all the sizes. And I didn't care if I looked like a slob because I just wanted – these were my fat clothes. And I always had a plan to lose weight, but I never did because why bother because I was fat. I'm fat and horrible and ugly. Why would I bother? Not worth it. So Nicole said, we're going to take you shopping and get you some good clothes. So we went to like a store, got a personal shopper in Vegas. And they got me, I mean, they were big clothes, but they were like designer clothes. And I thought, oh, I looked a little better, you know, and I was really happy getting this stuff that wasn't from the Gap. And all of a sudden I thought, oh, I deserve to look good and I deserve to have nice things and I can look good. And that gave me the trigger to think like, oh, why shouldn't I lose weight? I deserve it. Why shouldn't I try to make my body look better? I deserve it. And I really had to come up with this idea of even deserving to do that first before I even lost the weight. And the problem, the downward spiral when you're overweight or anything like that is people make you feel like, or people don't, you make you feel because you're looking at beautiful people in magazines or on the internet or whatever you're jacking off to or ads in the magazine, that's how you have to look to be attractive to people. And that's how you have to look to be worthwhile. Right. But you don't. You don't. And don't have to be a perfect body to be worthwhile and have love in your life. That's what I thought. So I was just, and then you're miserable. So you want to punish yourself by eating this like slow suicide that you put yourself through with sugar and everything else. And so to break out of that, you just have to start loving yourself more, whatever you have to do to love yourself. And the next thing you know, you deserve to work out. You deserve to be slim. You deserve to be healthy. And it's not even about being slim because I'm not, I'm like 20 pounds, 25 pounds overweight right now, but you just want to be healthy so you think you can live longer, just do active things. Like well, I used to get off prices, right? It would kill me.
Can we talk for a second about this concept of loving yourself? Like, you know, everybody hears that all the time. Love yourself, love yourself, love yourself. And yet it seems like a lot of people aren't really that familiar with what love even means. Like, what is, to you, how would you define love?
Well, it's got to be unconditional, you know, for one thing. And you don't, like, you can't, I'll tell you, when I took this Vipassana class, one of the nicest things about it was that I only looked in the mirror three times the whole 10 days. And that was to shave because my face was starting to itch. I didn't want that itchy face while I was meditating. So I looked in the mirror and I shaved. The whole rest of the time, I never looked. So I never got that. You're constantly looking in the mirror like, oh, I'm getting older. And oh, look, I'm fatter. Or, yeah. Oh, I'm so skinny. Or oh, yeah. My tits. Or oh, my dick is a bit. Like whatever you're looking at, you don't think right. You're good enough. Oh, my butt, you know, and oh, my clothes. And you get yeah. That little flash of judgment every time you walk by a glass on the street, a window pane, every time you look in the mirror, every time you're washing your hands, constantly all day. And I didn't have yeah. Any of that. And it was so freeing and nice. And I didn't realize until I got out. I was like, oh, my God, that was the greatest thing that right. I didn't have this self-judgment all the time. So you kind of have to get over that and get rid of that. It's a tough thing to do because most people have been telling themselves their whole life, I'm an 8. I'm a 5. You know, they rate themselves. They tell themselves who they deserve, who they don't deserve. Right. And you got to get over all that, you know.
But how? I mean, again, it's like you go to a Vipassana retreat. There's no mirrors. But from day to day, you hear, you know, when I think of loving myself or loving anyone for that matter, Drew, it seems theoretically to be like, I know what it means. And maybe if I'm on MDMA, I really know what it means. But in normal default reality, when you're just experiencing day-to-day life, which I think for a lot of people is varying moments of fear, anxiety, fluctuating numbness. How do you summon up this self-love that you hear again and again and again in so many scriptures and self-help books? How do you find it when it seems like there's just nothing there?
Oh, well, you know, one of the things is live a life of gratitude and live a life of thankfulness. Like, just remind yourself how lucky you are to, like, you have to count your blessings, man. That's a big part of
right.
it. You know, I mean, whatever you have, whatever you can be thankful for, just count your blessings and start doing that. And right away you feel like, oh, these are all good things about me. You know, I might not be good at math, but I'm good at English. I might not be a good athlete, but I'm smart. It might be like whatever yeah. it is about you that you can tell yeah. yourself you're good at or worthwhile about, just grab onto that like a life raft and just hold onto it as tight as you can, even if it's one thing.
No, I've heard, you know, there's a guy. Do you ever go to Agape Church? You ever listen to Michael Beckwith at all?
No.
You'd
I've heard
love
of Agape Church, but I've never been there.
He's amazing. But one of the things he says when you're trying to summon up gratitude, one of the things he says is just be grateful for the fact that you can hold your pee in. Like, start there. Like,
yeah.
You know what Seriously. I mean? Like, start at, like, just the fact if you can hold yourself upright, start there. If you are able to feel if your hands, because so many people in the world, they don't have this luxury. They're not able to do this. So even yeah. starting with some kind of aesthetic sense, maybe you don't have that, but just the fact that you're not constantly shitting yourself definitely puts you ahead of maybe 5% of your species, probably. Babies, for yeah. example, more than that, babies are always shitting themselves. So you could be glad of that. So I love that. I mean, I think it's very pragmatic because, you know, we hear so much this goddamn love yourself shit over and over and over again and it's true.
This goddamn love yourself shit. I'm tired of it.
No, but it's true. The problem is it's true, but it's like a perfume that we smell too much.
Yeah, well, also because people like to shit on themselves all the time because they felt that they have an agreement with themselves that they're not worthwhile. They hear love themselves like, oh my God, this fucking love myself shit.
Yeah.
Why would I have to, you know, get off
Well, not
me.
Even that.
Not, that
not even that. You think the responses I've gotten from people, if you even mention you should love yourself, some people have never even considered that. They haven't even thought of it. And when they do think about it, they say, oh, this is indulgent. Love yourself? You mean be egotistical? What's the difference between being a narcissist and loving yourself?
You can love yourself. I don't love myself above all others. for right. one thing. I don't think everybody else is a piece of shit because right. I think I'm worthwhile. Because I think sometimes people think they're worthwhile and nobody else is. They're above everybody else. You know, like I'm better than you because I have this. I have a Ferrari because I have this degree, because I have this job. I'm better than you because I live right. in this neighborhood, because I was born in this family and I was born in yes. this skin. So I'm better than you. I think that's a little, I don't know the definition, a total, the scientific definition of narcissism, but that's like a warped sense of self-worth. The idea is right. I'm okay and you're okay. You know, I'm worthwhile. You're worthwhile. We all have a place in the world. We all have our job to do. Everybody's taking part in helping the world go around. Everybody makes society great. I tell people at Price is Right all the time. So somebody came to me, somebody I asked what they did for a living. I always talk to the audience. I'm a busboy. I was the cockiest busboy in the world when I was a busboy.
Right.
When I was a dishwasher, I was like, if you don't treat me right, wash your own dishes and see how this restaurant goes. If you don't think I'm important, right. you don't think I'm worthwhile. Bust your right. own tables and see how you like it. You know, I'm as important as the restaurant's humming. The dishwasher is as important as the manager, is as important as the cook, is as important as everybody else that works there. If one person's not doing the job, the whole restaurant falls apart. And that's true right. with the whole world. Don't ever think you're worthwhile. Don't ever think your job is worthless. Don't ever think you're doing something menial. Everybody has a place in this world and an important thing to do.
That's beautiful, man. It really is. I love that. It's true. And it's the, but there does seem to be, at least in these books, they say that there is a direct correlation between abundance in your life and your ability to love yourself. And that if you're experiencing, you know, you do hear varying versions of the same story, which is if you hate yourself, like the best, sometimes the way I put it, it's like the example is, you know, you step on dog shit, right? And if right. you go around, and you're like, God, somebody smells like fucking dog shit. And then you're like, wow, who? You're like, oh, it's me.
That's totally happened to me.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that. Yeah.
That's but in the worst, man.
But in the same way, like people have a tiny little piece of dog shit stuck in their heart, and they go around the world and they're like, this world is dog shit. What a horrible yeah. world. Not realizing yeah. the fact that really it's not the world at all. It's the fact that inside of them is this tiny little piece of stinky negative energy that's gotten stuck inside of them. So, but again, I want to ask you, Drew, because in Buddhism, one of the things you hear again and again is there is no self, or our idea of what the self is not truly what the self is. But more often than not, you hear there really isn't a self, or if there is a self, it's a kind of transient, temporary thing that is a result of a kind of connection with all other things. So if the idea is to love yourself, what is it that you're loving? Are you loving your personality, your body, or is there some more ephemeral thing?
Well, maybe if I put it a different way, don't hate yourself. That makes more sense.
Yeah, yeah, that's easier. Yeah, I think that's
why.
Makes a
why
lot
would
more
you
sense.
Cause? Why would you cause yourself this pain, this unnecessary pain? It's not, you know, it's ridiculous. You know, it's part of honestly, that craving and aversion thing. It's part of that. It's like this idea of like, I'm not this thing that I want to be in my head. Therefore I'm unhappy because I can't have this.
Right.
You know,
right.
I can't
be
this version of me that I need to be. So you have to get rid of that and just be loving about who you are at this moment, no matter what you have. If you have no money, if you have money, if you have an education, if not, like okay. whatever you're, if you're sick, if you're not sick, whatever situation you find at this, love that and admire that and be happy with that, because otherwise it's a craving. You're saying to yourself, oh, I'm sick. I can't love myself and be happy unless I'm well. I'm not a healthy person yet. You know, I overeat. I do this or that. I can't be happy with myself until. Do you ever catch yourself with this? Because I still have to catch myself when I do this. I'm making a plan. You know, I'm going to lose 30 pounds. Let's say for I mean 80 pounds, whatever it was originally.
Yeah.
And after I lose that 80 pounds, then I'll be happy.
Yeah.
Do you ever catch yourself doing people that after I get my goal, I'll be happy? Well, that's causing a craving. And
right.
if you don't get it, you're telling yourself, I'm not going to be happy until this, I do this thing.
Yeah,
so
sure.
You have to love yourself no matter overweight, sick, whatever you are right now. Love yourself right now at this moment, or nothing is going to happen to you. Just be miserable. Why would you want to do that?
Okay. Let me tell you, maybe you can walk me through this. Let me tell you what happened to me today. Today, I did the mistake that you make where you're, I don't know if you make the mistake. I certainly make this mistake
all the time. I make mistakes all day.
I don't know if you make this mistake, the mistake where you eat too much weed and you're like, oh yeah, I think I know the amount to take. And so like, you're like, oh yeah, this is definitely the right amount. I'll be fine. And you eat it. And then all of a sudden it's like the Grim Reaper is just banging you on the head with his scythe. It's the right. So that happened. So that happened to me. That happened to me today. So
did you eat a whole Chiba Chew by yourself or something?
It was a Chiba Chew. You know me very well, but it was not a whole Chiba Chew. And honestly, it just seemed like a rather safe amount of Chiba Chew to eat. So I ate it. And then like, I'm driving to a cafe to get some coffee. And somewhere along the way, it was just like, oh my God, what the fuck is wrong with me? The world is ending. What have I done? And it was like, you know, like just like a rain of neurotic internal meteors just flying through my head. And so in that moment, all of a sudden I thought, okay, wait. Okay, this is a chance to practice what I've learned about Buddhism, what I've learned from Ram Dass. I'm just going to be in the present moment. And so I started breathing, and suddenly for like, I don't know, maybe like 10 milliseconds, maybe half a second, it was like, God, the world is so beautiful. God, I'm so lucky to be alive. And then my mind immediately thought, dude, you need more goals. You got to come up with some goals. And so then, right? So like, you can't just be fucking driving around stoned. You got to have goals. You can't look at the nature as beautiful. You got to have a purpose. Like, you need to worry. So Drew, when that happens, what is a person to do when you have this one part of your mind that's like, my God, we are in the Garden of Eden, and another part that's telling you, fuck that.
Would this garden be great if there was a house here? Would this garden be better if we had central heating? Would this garden be better if we had some misters?
Yes, exactly. How do you get past that? How do you?
Well, first of all, you don't need a whole fucking Chiba Chew. That's step one. If I was an alcoholic, quit drinking, you'd be a lot happier.
Yeah.
But okay. I mean, it's kind of half serious, because in the Vipassana thing, you're not allowed to have any alcohol or any kind of like, anything like that, or any kind of extra thing. They ask you like to not drink or anything like that, because that interferes with your thought process.
Yes.
In kind of a bad way sometimes. So, I mean, you're kind of asking for it when you get high and think like that. So my first, I mean, who doesn't like to get high, but I would not judge myself on what I thought while I was high.
Yeah,
like when you have those thoughts, you have to realize that you were high when you had that. So don't don't judge yourself or even worry about it now. You were high when it happened.
No.
So
I'm not,
let it go, relax.
I'm always high. It's not that and also the to me, it's like
he's a space invader.
To me, it's not like, I have no problem writing off the Chiba Chew thing, but I think even when I'm not high or when I'm not tripping, it seems to be the part of the mind that is in charge is not the part of the mind that is accepting the beauty of life, but it's the planning part of the mind. Right. So what do you do about that part of the mind?
It's the pot. Just don't judge it. Just let it happen. And when it goes away, just forget about it. Go back to being you.
Okay, but what about when you're not high and that same part of your mind is there? Like, you bought me that book called, what's it called? Sapiens, right? And it's really good. And okay, it's a great book. It's a great book. But one of the things I didn't know is that humans use 25%. 25% of your energy is going to running your brain. So we've got this like incredible supercomputer running inside our heads, stoned or not, that is like processing 24/7. So
all the time.
So what have you learned from Vipassana about how to deal with that like that computer that you can't shut down, that you call your mind. Oh man,
it's such a process. I mean, don't think that you go to take a Vipassana course and then you get out and you're all of a sudden like a light switch went off and you're a perfect Buddha being that you're right. Jesus all of a sudden. The way they put it is you might have like 100 stones when you're carrying 100 stones when you come in, and when you leave, you get 1 stone taken away. And you meditate for another year, another stone gets taken away.
Wow.
It's like this slow process. The best thing you can do, though, is whenever, because that happens to everybody, they call it in the Vipassana world, they call it monkey mind, because it's like your thoughts are swinging branch to branch. And you, like the idea, when you meditate, like your mind wanders constantly. And as soon as you realize your mind is wandering, you bring it back and just concentrate on your breath and go back to the technique. And the idea is to stop the monkey mind. But then you might have like, out of the hour meditation session, you might have 50 minutes of monkey mind without even being aware of it. And then you're like, oh God, my mind has been wandering this whole time. Go back to normal. But the way to get around it is accept that it happens and then just forgive yourself and don't judge yourself about it. Because it's perfectly normal. It happens to everybody. And it's a practice. And you want to practice not doing it. And the meditation is that practice, you know, for an hour or two a day, however often you meditate. And don't even worry about it.
Did they do a guided meditation?
Because it happens.
Did they do it when you went to the, it's great. But did they do a guided meditation with you when you went there?
It's a silent meditation, and they teach you a technique like the night before, and then you spend the next day practicing. And the guy that teaches it is he's dead now. He teaches it through audio and video recordings. And he just, like at the beginning, he'll go like, remember, breathe through your nose and, you know, concentrate on your breath. He'll give you a reminder for the meditation. Can you walk us through it?
Like the process? Can everyone sitting here do a quick meditation? No.
No, but you can go.
Why not?
It's not a conducive thing. You need to be like in a quiet place alone, no distractions. Like you don't wear glasses or jewelry because you don't want to feel that. Like you don't want to feel your glasses on your head. I wear comfortable, like loose clothes, like sweatpants and a t-shirt. So I don't feel any like belt or shoes or anything on me.
Right.
And the first thing they teach you though, the very first day, is you concentrate on your breath. So you close your eyes, close your mouth and just breathe through your nose. And all you do is remain as still as you can with your body, close your eyes, get a quiet, no distractions, and just concentrate on your breath. And just think about your breath coming in and out, nothing else. And as soon as your mind wanders, go back to your breath. And if you just do that, that's just like an easy, basic thing. You'll always be able to breathe. And that's like and then it gets more complicated from there, where you do like a body scan on the fourth day and all this kind of stuff. But the original thing is just concentrate on your breath. And that's like the basic part of it. And you can get that from the website. You can just go there and learn it from the website. And it's not the only form of meditation too. Pretty much every day. Some days I miss.
Here's a question for you. And then we're going to open the floor up for questions.
Sure.
You're one of the most successful like people I know. So one question I used to ask people at the end of my podcast is, if you could give the people listening some advice, not like some ephemeral advice, though I do think, or like some like love yourself is great advice. But if you could give people like an actionable thing that they could do over the next few days that you think would create a positive shift in their existence, what would that thing be?
Well, I mean, everybody's seeking a different thing. So you have to be your own seeker. You know, like if I could give you advice, it might not apply to you because you might have that dealt with already. So with that caveat, I always recommend, like on Price is Right, I mean, 18-year-olds that have just graduated high school, and I always give them this advice. I tell them to go get any book they can about setting goals. Because I tell them to do what I did. Get any book you can. I'm like, just go to – there's lots of them. I did Think and Grow Rich, Zig Ziglar books, Dennis Waitley. And just go to Amazon and look up goal setting books. And don't read just one, but read a bunch of them. And learn to be an expert goal setter. Because if you learn how to set goals for yourself that are only you – you know, I'll give you the vision board example. Everybody knows what a vision board is, right? All it is you'd use a big giant board and you put pictures of things that you want on there, like how fit you want to be, the car you want to drive, the house you want to live in, you know, that kind of thing. The man or woman you want to date, just like your goals for your life, but in picture form. And if you don't do that for yourself, somebody else is making your vision board for you. Every ad you see, every porno you look at, every book you read, every TV show, it's all a bunch of random strangers that don't give a fuck about you. They don't care whether you're happy or not. They just want you to do this goal that I have set for you. You must buy this pizza. You must go on this vacation. You must do this thing. And they're going to give you your own vision board. Unless you do your own and have your own fucking line in life, they're going to do it for you. So find your own goals. Find your own way to live your life, no matter what it is. And don't live your life by what somebody else wants you to do. Live your life how you want to do. And the only way to do that successfully is to learn how to set goals. So I would tell you that.
Beautiful. That Drew Carey, everybody. Let him hear it. Drew Carey. Give him a round of emoticon applause. That was great, man. Beautiful, man. That was really cool, Drew. Thank you. That was really cool. So, all right, guys. So what we're going to do now, we're just going to like take some questions and to ask questions. I don't know exactly how you do it, but theoretically, if you raise your hand, I'm going to be able to point at you and take your question. So some people are in some people. Let me see. Okay, here we go. Let's see what happens if this works. If it doesn't, we're going to have to get someone in alt space to do it. I don't think my control. There we go. Are you there? No. Hey, Altspit, can you guys like help people ask questions? Because it's not working for me.
Sure. So, Rico, you are live.
Cool. Yeah. Hey, guys. How you going? Down. I mean,
there we go.
It's Richo, but close enough. You're in the ballpark.
Sorry.
Cool. No, we're good, guys. So I was just gonna ask. So I try to practice mindfulness. It's really bad sometimes. You slack off and you just completely stop and. When you do it, it's amazing. It's this beautiful feeling when you start taking that time to actually just think about everything, like every, I guess, the minutiae of life, and just feeling, you know, you think about when I'm walking, I just think about when I take a step and feeling in my shoes and the wind on my hands, all that sort of stuff. Have you ever practiced that great length where you really try to take in everything you're doing through the day as opposed to, you know.
Yeah, and the Vipassana course,
Vipassana course, the best 2 days for me were they asked that you be mindful 24 hours a day for 2 days straight. Mm. So just like you said, you want to feel like the pants, how your skin feels when your pants are moving against it when you're walking, how the breeze feels against your thing. How when you eat an apple, like the, you want to feel like the apple in your hand, how it feels when it hits your lips, how it feels when you're chewing
Joey,
it, how the water feels when you're taking a shower, how the sheets feel when you're laying in bed. All that stuff, like every second, be mindful of the sensation against your skin and what's happening. And, you know, when I talk about this stuff, don't think that I'm like this all the time. Like I get annoyed with everybody just like everybody else does. I'm not a perfect person by any means. This is an ideal that I'm going for.
I've watched Drew kill people.
Practice. No. But he's also seen me when I'm like – I mean, it doesn't happen as often as it used to, but I'd be like, what the fuck, you know, sometimes it's not as, I used to be like a maniac sometimes, but now it's like hardly, yeah, but don't think that I'm up here like that I'm presenting myself as this perfect person who never loses his temper or goes off or, you know, or never thinks badly of himself. Like I think awful things about myself all day or unworthwhile thoughts, but I snap out of it quicker and I have it's not as bad as it used to be. So it's that one stone at a time theory.
Guys, for me, when you're looking at me, I am a perfect person. I haven't felt sadness, sorrow, or grief for years. Every day is the most beautiful day and it's just wonderful. So let's take another question.
Enzo, you're live.
Hi, Enzo. Yeah,
quick question.
Hi, Enzo.
Hi. Thunderdome. Sure. Two men enter, one man leaves. You versus Alex Trebek. Who leaves?
Are you talking about like a physical battle?
Yes.
I would want to do a physical battle with
talk show host, game show.
I love Alex Trebek.
Oh, probably I wouldn't lift a finger to hurt Alex Trebek. So
no,
probably
you have to, Drew. Wanted to kick my ass. You have to. Here's the thing. You got to fight. This is the Thunderdome. It's the end of the world. Some bandits somehow managed to – they've managed to capture you, Alex Trebek. They've put you in a Thunderdome together. If you guys don't fight, they're going to kill like 17 orphans. So, like, you have to fight. Who wins?
Oh,
I like kick your ass.
Yes,
okay. I win.
I don't know, man. Trebek seems like he would hide a dagger in his asshole or something. He seems like they would have some terrible trick.
Oh my god.
He I'll seems take like
dagger
a
assholes for 500, please.
Okay, great question, Enzo. Thanks. Let's do another question.
Just one.
Go ahead. I think Alt Space is picking people out.
Ryan, you're live.
Hi, Ryan.
Hi, Drew.
Hey, Ryan.
Hey, Ryan.
How many licks does it take to get the Tootsie Roll center of a Tootsie Pop?
I always bite it.
You would.
So a few, and then I get bored, and then I bite it.
All right, let's do another.
Okay, I'm gonna feel free to ask whatever you want, but let's. I mean, we have two people here that have very insightful questions, abilities here. So, all right, Gunter, go for it.
Yeah, so I'm enlightened. Ask us how to achieve world peace. It's your only hope.
It takes as many licks as the Tootsie Roll wants me to take. That's how many licks it takes to get to the center of the Tootsie Roll. How about that, brother? Huh?
Yeah.
Oh, you know what I'm talking about? Yeah.
Let's do another question.
Yeah, you don't stop the Tootsie Roll until the Tootsie Roll says you're done, bitch. That's when. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I apologize.
Yes, how are you doing?
Hello?
Nice to meet you.
Oh, okay. I'm talking. I was going to ask.
Cool, awesome, yoga, man, so, cool.
I was going to ask about materialism.
Wait, hold on a second, Yobi. So Gunter's asking a question.
Yes, Gunter's asking a question. You'll be next, Yobi. And we're going to have to repeat Gunter's question because he's in the room with us. So not everybody will be able to hear what he's saying. Go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead. Oh, my God.
I remember that.
I can't.
Okay, we were on our way to EDC.
We have to repeat the question. The question is, Gunter saw a video of us riding in Drew's car on Periscope going to EDC, the Electric Daisy Carnival.
Daisy Carnival.
In Vegas. Yeah.
It ended up being one of the best weekends of our life because we were at EDC.
Yeah, but also we're undercover cops. So we went there. Nobody expects. The reason it was such a great weekend is because we busted hundreds of people because no one expects Drew Carey to be a cop. So it's
yeah,
a
like
really.
I go up to people and go, hey, man, do you have any Molly? And they go, sure. And they give me one. I go, guess what, bitch? You're busted. And then I arrest them and then it's all over.
Yeah. But right before he arrests them. Right before he arrests them, he eats the Molly, which is like, you shouldn't do that, man. But
I got to test it and see if it's any good. So that I can tell if it's real Molly or not. Then I know it's real Molly, then I can put him in jail.
Yeah, but it's
I don't
cool.
Feel bad. I really like him at the same time. I feel bad while I put him in jail. That's the only problem.
Yeah, it's really weird to watch you put people in the squad car when you're like, I love you so much. You're really a beautiful person. I have to arrest you.
Just hugging him, you know. Yeah. It's all part
all
of
right.
the process.
Well, thanks, sure. man. We'll take another question.
Was I Ionovo or whatever?
Yovi.
Iovi.
All right.
Okay, Iovi, how you doing, buddy?
Hi, Iovi. But I was gonna.
Hi, Iovi.
Oh, sorry.
Materialistic values. Like, how do you get past that? Because I mean, I find myself struggling with I couldn't live without a lot of things, but I know I really could, but really I can't. You know, you get what I'm saying? Like, how do you get past?
Oh, like, why do you need like the latest 75-inch HD 4K TV and all that kind of thing when you could watch a show on your computer
mentally?
You don't have to. I mean, there's nothing wrong with living a comfortable life. I watched a really good documentary on happiness and it really hit home with me. One of the things, like, there's like a few basic things to be like winning a Super Bowl makes you happy. Hitting a scratcher ticket makes you happy, but it's all temporary happiness. Like it'll come and it'll go away. But for like baseline, bottom line happiness, where you're just a happy person all the time, you need a few things. One is, enough money to pay your bills so you're not sweating a bill. So living within your means. And that's tricky for some people because like if you're making $50,000 a year,
you need to live a $40,000 a year lifestyle and teach yourself to be happy with it, you know? And like, instead of, you know, going, oh, I don't have a big enough TV to watch the game, go to a sports bar. You have a much better experience. Instead of talking about how small your apartment is, go to the park. You have a much better, you have a better time at the park than you would at my house, because the park is nicer and it's bigger and there's more stuff to do. But as long as you're, but that scales up too. Like, if you make $1 million a year, you're not going to be happy if you're living $1.5 million a year lifestyle, because you'll always be worried about your money coming in and you'll be miserable. So that's one thing. And then having a lot of family and friends, that a circle of family and friends you can count on and you can confide in and be comfortable with and close to. And the other one is to do good things for other people. But the money part, I mean, you could be, I mean, it's tough because you know, I'm rich now, but I wasn't always rich. But I was happy before I wasn't rich, because I just learned to love what I have. And I really do believe that. Like, if you have, you know, I like my stuff and I like my house, but I have a better time. I honestly have a better time if I go to an ESPN bar or something to watch a game than I would at my house. Because it's just,
yeah, right.
I should be around people. It's just, and it doesn't cost anything. Like, most of the biggest joys I have are not because of the money I have, you know. Except when getting a private table at EDC or something like that. But even then, I think, like, oh, it's more fun to be down in the shit and be in the dance floor area than it is just to sit in the VIP all the time. People miss out sometimes.
Yeah,
you
know,
being miserable. But that the money part, you know, is if you're living within your means and not stretching it, you'd be a lot happier than if you're not.
Drew has 3 genetically engineered unicorns that he keeps in his backyard.
I don't. Yeah. Seems like a theft.
Any other? Let's get another question. Questions? Oh, someone has to pick you guys out. I can't do it.
There you go. Hi, guest.
Oh, is that me? Okay.
Yeah.
So a lot of people become more creative when they smoke weed or they drink. Personally, me, when I drink, and I'm guessing Duncan when he smokes, but about meditation, it seems like meditation kind of like, well, you won't have like a creative focus on a thought, because you're not really thinking.
No, not while you're meditating, you won't, no.
Okay.
But when you get done meditating, you do. Like, it really, like when you get done meditating, like, your mind is clear and you're open, and all of a sudden you're not as judgmental. You don't, like, sometimes when you're creative, when you're trying to be creative, you automatically discount things. Like, you ignore the sale before you knock on the door. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You'll think of something that's no good without ever exploring it. Ah. When you start meditating, you get rid of all that and you start to explore more and open your mind more, and it actually helps you be more creative.
Okay. Cause I thought, you know, actually, meditating was like, it was almost like a function of becoming more creative. Like when your inhibitors go down, like smoking weed or drinking or something like that. But that's not
I don't find I'm really creative. Like, when I'm meditating, I shut down, you know, that's when I shut my mind off. But then the rest of the day is better and more creative for me because I did meditate. That makes sense.
Yeah, definitely. Okay.
And I've heard one thing that Ram Dass talks about is how sometimes when you're meditating, your mind will actually begin to trick you into thinking like, oh, fuck, I've got to go write that down. This is the greatest idea ever. Okay. And the idea is you just allow that idea to come and to go, and you just sit and watch them drift by. And I do think that if you get in the practice of meditating, then it makes you better throughout the day. It probably produces more of those epiphanies, I would say.
Yeah, there's this important teaching in the meditation in Buddhism. It's called the Dhamma wheel or the Dharma wheel. I don't know if you've ever heard of it. It's like, you can look at pictures of it. It's like things come and go. The wheel goes to the top, then it goes down to the bottom. You know, you're happy, then you're sad, you have money, you have health, you're born, you die. It's all a big circle all the time. And one of the practices during that 10 days, there was starting the fourth day, there was 3 separate hour-long meditation sessions. They all vary in length, they're timed out differently all through the day. But for the 3 different hour ones, they called it the hour of great determination. And so if you were sitting perfectly still like this when he started, that's how you weren't supposed to move a muscle. Like, don't move your head around. Don't shrug your shoulders. Don't stretch. Nothing. Don't even move your hands like this or wiggle your fingers. Just sit perfectly still for the whole hour. And I would feel like an itch come on my face,
and I could feel the itch like starting and then moving and then moving to another part of my face and then going away. I would feel ache in my back start and just like I could feel it grow and move and go to a different part of my back and then go away. And the same thing like that, these thoughts would like come and go. And that's part of the practice, is the letting go that everything's temporary, nothing's permanent, even suffering, even happiness. So don't get attached to it. Let go of these attachments, because everything comes and goes. It's all part of the practice. But yeah, Ram Dass is right. Even the thoughts, when you think like, oh, I have to get this thought, the thoughts are just temporary here and there. You don't have to attach yourself to them and let it go. It's good practice.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, it is. It's really cool to watch the different ways your mind will try to trick you into being sucked back into it again. It's all your ego. Yeah. Let's do two more questions.
Hey, Duncan, is it okay if I ask a question from the team?
Yeah, sure. Please.
Somebody wanted to ask Drew, what's your favorite part of Seattle? Question from Chelsea.
Oh, I own part of a soccer team up in Seattle. They're called the Seattle Sounders. And, that's my favorite part of the whole city, is that team and the fans that support it. They're so supportive and they're so great, and they give so much to the team. And I was just up there on Sunday. It was just an amazing experience, how everybody supports us. And it's one of the best business experiences I've ever had, besides the Price is Right, as owning part of that soccer team. It's great. So that's one of my greatest things about Seattle.
Thanks for answering that.
Cool.
Sure.
Okay.
Let's do it. You pick it out.
Okay. Let's see.
Sorry, we can't get to everybody.
Can you hear me?
Yeah. Can you yes. hear
me? Yeah. So.
How you doing, man?
And on the Price is Right, do you get really pissed off when someone wins by bidding that dollar over?
No, and I'll tell you, I'm glad you asked that, because I get a lot of things on Twitter like, you got to stop this rule. It's the worst thing, but. What really happens is that sometimes, like, if somebody will bid like 500 and somebody go 501, and they're like, oh, you screwed that other person, but then the actual retail price would be $2,000. So they're actually off by a lot. But why would you just go over a dollar just to cover yourself? Somebody lost the other day. They bid, it was like 1,000, and then somebody wanted to give them a break, so they went 1,050, so they wouldn't go a dollar over and be that person. But then the price was was like 1,025 or something. It was right in between. So if that person just would have went 1,001, they would have won. And to me, it's a perfectly legitimate strategy. I would do it all the time. And if you ever like look online for like Price is Right strategies, if you're the last person, that's actually one of the best strategies to win and get up on stage. Just go a dollar over what you think the other person did. And I don't have any problem with it. And I think it's to me, it's just a fascinating part of the game. You know, it's just it's a technique you can use. I don't have any problem with that. Somebody going a dollar over. I know people are going to not like it.
I do. I think it fucking sucks, man. Let's do
thank you guys.
So we're gonna take a break for a second, but then we're gathering together again in the Medieval Tavern just to hang out. Drew, I hope you'll come hang out for a second. It's super
absolutely.
fun.
Thanks for listening, everybody. That was Drew Carey in Altspace VR. If you want to see that in virtual reality, you can go over to Altspace and they are running it there. It's somewhere on a loop. I'll have the link at duncantrussell.com. Much thanks to squarespace.com for sponsoring this episode. If you go to Squarespace and use offer code Duncan, you will get 10% off of your first purchase. Sign up for a year and you will get a free domain name. Make sure you use our Amazon link, that you subscribe to us on iTunes. Give us a nice rating if you like this episode. I'll see you guys real soon. Hare Krishna.